Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, it's Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast. It's Wednesday, July 13th. Here's one revelation from yesterday's January 6th committee hearing. President Donald Trump planned to tell the crowd at his January 6th rally to march to the Capitol. But he and his advisors concealed that fact from the public and never got a permit for the march. Why conceal the planned march? We'll explore that in a minute. But here's another revelation from yesterday's hearing, very related. On the night of January 6th, after the riot, Trump's former campaign manager, Brad Parscale, and Trump advisor, Katrina Pearson, who helped organize January 6th, had an exchange of text messages in which Parscale wrote, "A sitting president calling for civil war. This week I feel guilty for helping him win." He helped him win in 2016. Pearson replied, "You did what you felt at the time, therefore it was right." Parscale wrote, "If I was Trump and knew my rhetoric killed someone..." Pearson disagreed, writing, "It wasn't the rhetoric." Parscale replied, "Katrina, yes, it was." That's dramatic, right? And revealing, because right there on the 6th, someone that close to Trump was blaming his rhetoric for inciting the violence. By the way, Brad Parscale now works for a Trump-related political action committee again, but that's another story. And that ties to testimony from the previous hearing when White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson testified about a warning from White House counsel Pat Cipollone advising against going to the Capitol, saying they would be charged with all kinds of things imaginable if they did that. They would leave themselves open to that criminal liability, including this.
He was also worried that it would look like we were inciting a riot or encouraging a riot to erupt on the Capitol, at the Capitol.
Cipollone was worried that it would look like we were inciting a riot or encouraging a riot to erupt at the Capitol. That was before January 6th. So that testimony indicates Trump was warned by his White House counsel about inciting a riot by sending protesters to the Capitol. He did it anyway. And afterwards, his former campaign manager said Trump's rhetoric caused it, including the death of the rioter who was shot by police. And that was the point of yesterday's hearing, really, the present evidence and testimony tying Trump to the plans for violence at the Capitol leading up to January 6th. Next week's hearing will focus on his relationship to the violence once it began. With us now, Washington Post national correspondent Philip Bump. One of his articles in the last day is called "Why Evidence That Trump Planned a Capitol March is Important." Philip, always good to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much, sir.
Let's start with Trump planning to send the crowd to the Capitol, but concealing that fact from the public. The committee revealed a tweet that Trump considered but never sent, announcing the march in advance. Can you tell the story of that tweet?
Yeah, so it was fascinating for a number of reasons, including the fact that it was this printout of a proposed tweet for Donald Trump that was stamped with a stamp that said, you know, viewed by the president, essentially, indicating some interesting background about how Donald Trump actually went about releasing his tweets. That's beside the point, nonetheless interesting. But what the tweet said essentially was that it gave people details on what to expect on January 6th. It was clearly not written on January 6th itself, since it said it referred, you know, looking forward to the date of January 6th, but it included a mention that a march to the Capitol would follow his speech that morning. That was not something that was part of the stated public plans for the White House. It was, however, something that had been an element of what the outside allies who helped put together the events on both January 5th and January 6th had been planning for some time. When Donald Trump on December 19th, 2020 released his tweet saying that people should be in D.C. on January 6th because it will be wild, that infamous tweet, very quickly allies put together a plan for a number of events that were sort of merged together, including Trump's speech and then something at the Capitol. But they didn't have a permit for an actual march. And there was a debate about whether such a march was actually a good idea.
And you're right, so that the fact that the tweet was never sent suggests that he or his team got the message that they shouldn't say that part out loud about planning a march, not just a rally. Was that because of advice, like from White House counsel Cipollone, that he would look like he was inciting a riot?
I think that's probably the safest assumption. I mean, we know that Donald Trump was very actively encouraging people to come and be a part of the events on that day. He did on January 1st, I believe, retweet a relatively old tweet that was calling for a, quote, Trump march, which was sort of, both pointing people to the 6th that also highlighting the idea of a march. But we've heard this testimony saying that his lawyers were very fervent in saying, look, you can't do this. You should not, you certainly yourself should not go there, but you should not even direct people to the Capitol because it raises all sorts of legal problems. And the idea I think that is safe to take away from this is that on this, at least, the advice of his lawyers was heeded.
But when January 6th came, Trump did implore the crowd to march to the Capitol, and of course they did, and sure enough, there was a riot. So did the committee hear evidence or draw a conclusion from that, that Trump wanted a riot at the Capitol since he had been warned about exactly that but sent the crowd there anyway?
There's sort of, if you read between the lines, I don't think that anyone who sits on the House Select Committee has much doubt that Donald Trump wanted to see a large crowd there and was not dissatisfied when they actually interrupted the electoral vote count. I'm not sure that, and I don't know if any of them are sure, they certainly haven't presented concrete evidence to this fact, but I'm not sure that Donald Trump anticipated there would be a violent riot there necessarily. We know, however, from Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony last week that he understood that people in the crowd were armed and that those armaments were not intended to hurt him. We know as well that he was working behind the scenes. He had a plan. Other evidence that came out yesterday included his allies being pretty clear with others that Donald Trump had a sort of quiet plan to push people to the Capitol, that there was an expectation he would push people to the Capitol, even if that wasn't what they had agreed that he was going to do, and that's not what they were publicly saying. So Donald Trump came to the Capitol, came to the Ellipse that day, knew that there were people with arms there, intended to push them to the Capitol, and, you know, you can sort of put two and two together to get four, even if there isn't, you know, a smoking gun saying that Donald Trump said, hey, I want to have a riot there. Yeah. He did everything else necessary.
Alex Jones, the InfoWars conspiracy theorist talk show host, said Trump wants the American people to march on Washington. And Steve Bannon on his radio show on the 5th said this.
All hell is going to break loose tomorrow. It's all converging. And now we're on, as they say, the point of attack, right? The point of attack tomorrow. I'll tell you this. It's not going to happen like you think it's going to happen. Okay, it's going to be quite extraordinarily different. And all I can say is strap in.
That's a longer version of that clip of Steve Bannon than we've used before. And I wanted to get that one on because I think the end of that has been minimized too much. Everybody's playing the part where he says all hell is going to break loose tomorrow. But that second half where he says this is going to be much different than people think it's going to be, strap in. That indicates something, right?
I think one of the challenges we have with someone like Steve Bannon or Alex Jones is it's very hard to differentiate the bluster from the reality, right? I mean, Steve Bannon obviously had access to a lot of people in the White House. He's in conversation with folks. But Steve Bannon is also known to be a bloviator, right? I mean, he goes out of his way to say things to make himself sound important, to make everything seem more dramatic than it is. It served him well in terms of his media career. I don't know. I mean, I would love to know more about the conversations that Bannon had with the White House. I'm sure the January 6th committee, you know, they've been very actively trying to get testimony from Bannon. That's been the subject of a recent court fight. I think they want to know as well. I find it very hard to give Bannon the benefit of the doubt that he actually knew something because he would go out of his way to insinuate that he knew something even if he didn't.
Interesting. So we'll see if he actually testifies, if there's actually anything to learn from that, or if it's all him kind of promoting himself. Right. But then there were those who Trump might have known, or his inner circle should have known, and arguably probably did know, were actually planning violence. So another Washington Post article by some of your colleagues on yesterday's hearing goes down this partial list as presented by the committee from after Trump tweeted, "Be there, we'll be wild," about the coming event. It says, Tim Pool, a prominent YouTuber, said of January 6th, this could be Trump's last stand, and Matt Bracken, a right-wing commentator, became specific, envisioning storming right into the Capitol. Further afield, the tweet, the Will Be Wild tweet, caused violent rhetoric to course through anonymous pro-Trump sectors of the internet. Trump just told us all to come armed, one message read. Another user said volunteers were needed, quote, for the firing squad. Some of the messages, the article continues, were openly homicidal, according to committee member Jamie Raskin, who presented this yesterday, and littered with racist and genocidal rallying cries. One asked, why don't we just kill them, every last Democrat? Another said, white revolution is the only solution. A post on the popular pro-Trump forum, thedonald.win, envisioned police officers, quote, laying on the ground in a pool of blood, police officers. The site's founder, Jody Williams, told the committee that the president's tweet focused attention on January 6th. A post on that forum pressed, join your local Proud Boys chapter as well. And the article goes on, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, some of whose members have been indicted on charges of conspiracy related to January 6th, responded immediately to Trump's call. Kelly Meggs, the head of the Florida branch of the Oath Keepers, took to Facebook the morning of December 19th to declare an alliance between the two groups, writing, we have decided to work together and shut this expletive down. So all that from the hearing yesterday, most of it read by Jamie Raskin and summed up there in the Washington Post. So, Philip, all that evidence that the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, known to be violence risks, were using language like that, plus the randos cited there who were threatening far worse even, as quoted, did they present evidence yesterday that Trump or Kylie Kramer, who held the permit, or anyone else involved knew about those threats and those plans?
Not explicitly, no. And I think it's important to recognize, and I think we all sort of do implicitly, but I think it's worth stating, to recognize the spectrum on which this sort of language operates, right? So there are a lot of people who both, you know, even now, but especially at the time, will use all sorts of heated language about this is 1776 and yada, 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 to sort of be melodramatic and to sort of inject emotion and inject their own sense of self into what actually is going to be happening. And the importance of the moment and the importance of them and their cause. Like, people like to use that sort of rhetoric. The challenge was, in part, on January 6th, that we had so many people there who were so fired up and got caught up in this mob that was surging toward the Capitol. But then secondarily, we had these people who were actively trying to incite violence, people like the Oath Keepers who came planning to actually serve as a sort of reactionary force on Trump's behalf, people like the Proud Boys who very eagerly jumped into violence as they had it at rallies in November and December, you know, immediately prior to what happened on January 6th. So we have like these isolated comments on 8chan and 4chan, which I think are sort of easy to cherry pick as examples of rhetoric of people just sort of saying things. But I think you have these very real, very dangerous organizations and very dangerous people who then showed up on January 6th. You know, whether or not we know that there was a connection between them and the White House, I think is almost irrelevant. Because what Donald Trump did is Donald Trump said, hey, everyone get here, everyone be angry, everyone, this thing is being stolen from you, our country is at risk. He used that sort of inciting language, which everyone then pointed to as saying, yes, this is what we need to fight for, and people came prepared to fight. And I think that's the important distinction here.
And one of the witnesses yesterday to that point was a convicted January 6th rioter named Stephen Ayers, who has since come to regret his participation and testified how the social media world he followed had wrongly convinced him that the election was stolen and he personally had to do something about it. And Trump's December 19th tweet promoting the coming January 6th rally, Be There Will Be Wild, about that, Stephen Ayers said this.
You know, we went basically to see the Stop the Steal rally and that was it.
So why'd you decide to march to the Capitol?
The president, you know, got everybody riled up, told everybody head on down. So we basically were just following what he said.
And we have a caller reacting to Stephen Ayers' testimony. So let's go to Kathy in the Bronx. Kathy, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian.
What are you thinking?
Hello.
Hi, Kathy. Can you hear me?
Good morning. Thank you. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah. What you got on Philip, okay. On Stephen?
Good morning. Thank you so much. I love your show, and I think you're a treasure. Stephen, I was so upset yesterday listening to that because I could, in some ways, identify as just a regular American. And you get caught up in things that you hear sometimes and just following that. And I think that, you know, he's paying a price. He lost his job. He lost his home. You know, his family is affected. And, you know, the man who will be unnamed is not paying a real price at this point. And I, you know, it's frustrating. It makes me angry. You know, and I think whether this results in any criminal charges, I think it needs to be, as one of your speakers at one time said, you know, we just need to make sure that this man is nowhere near a source of power again.
Kathy, thank you very much. And we'll get more in a few minutes into what forms of accountability there could be for Donald Trump for all of this. Philip, as you might imagine, about half our caller board is people with kind of similar thoughts to what Kathy was expressing at the end there. Trump should be held accountable like this. Trump should be held accountable like that. We'll get to that. But what did you take away from Stephen Ayer's testimony that Kathy was referring to? And of course, we played the clip.
Well, honestly, I had a sort of personal element to it. He's from a town called Champion in Northeast Ohio, which is very close to where I went to high school. And it's an area, Trumbull County, just outside of Youngstown, which is made one of the sharpest turns to the right in 2016 to support Donald Trump. And it really is the sort of place, you know, for all of the discussion of, you know, the intermingled factors of race and economics that helped power Donald Trump's rise in 2016, this is sort of the nexus of a lot of that transition. And so I saw in him, I actually went back last year in 2020 and talked to a bunch of my former high school classmates about how they felt about the election and how they felt about Trump. And I saw in him a representation of a sort of political respondent who was very familiar to me, of someone who got caught up in this thing, who believed that the country was at risk and imperiled, and who believed Donald Trump and saw Donald Trump as someone who was actually going to do the sorts of things that politicians had for years been pledging to do. So it was hard for me to extricate from Ayer's testimony to sort of see it in the macrocosm, because I was so focused on the microcosm of who he was and what he represented, and the fact that he only belatedly came to the realization that Donald Trump was full of nonsense. I think one of the most telling parts of his testimony was he was asked if he still believed the election was stolen, and he sort of hemmed a little bit. He wasn't quite sure. You know, he said he knew that he should say no, but he was a little cautious in doing so. And I think that too also speaks to the power of Donald Trump's insistence. If you believe Donald Trump and he's saying this thing so insistently, you're going to believe him and you're going to think, hey, this was really stolen. Our country's really at risk. And that, of course, was the fundamental danger.
You know, there is a counter narrative, a Trump counter narrative that I've heard from Peter Navarro, one of the core Trump people at that time, who himself is being held in contempt of Congress at the moment for refusing to testify before the committee. But he did go on MSNBC with Ari Melber. And Peter Navarro says the last thing we wanted was a riot. We were trying to get Congress to use these parliamentary moves, questionable as they may be. But, you know, he says they were trying to get Congress to use these parliamentary moves and Mike Pence to use what they saw as his power to send the election back to the states and continue the process. The rioting discredited that process. So the rioting was not in their interest, not in Trump's interest. Does evidence suggest that might have been their point of view?
I would say this is what the kids today call a retcon, which is trying to sort of revise what actually happened. Peter Navarro is not really credible on any of this stuff. And, you know, he said that Mike Pence should be, accused of treason for having not gone along with Trump's plan. We know that Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani were calling legislators as the riot was underway, trying to continue to cajole them to stand up in opposition to the electoral votes and actually insisting that, hey, we just need more time so that we can get these state legislatures to potentially revoke their submitted electors. They were using the riot to their advantage to enact the exact plan that Peter Navarro says this worked against. So I just think it's simply not credible.
So here's one final clip, which seems to promote a revelation to come at the next hearing. It's Committee Vice Chair Liz Cheney. And in the previous hearings, she suggested Trump could be guilty of witness tampering by some of the ways he might be reaching out to people scheduled to testify. Yesterday, Cheney said this.
After our last hearing, President Trump tried to call a witness in our investigation, a witness you have not yet seen in these hearings. That person declined to answer or respond to President Trump's call and instead alerted their lawyer to the call. Their lawyer alerted us, and this committee has supplied that information to the Department of Justice. Let me say one more time, we will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously.
So, Philip, do you have a scoop yet on who that future witness is?
I don't. You know, I think that it's sort of interesting because Cheney did something similar at the end of the Cassidy Hutchinson hearing as well, articulating actual specific appeals from Trump world to have people sort of be like, hey, look, you know, we know whose team you're on and you'll be rewarded for you know, staying loyal, that sort of thing. I think that there's sort of a meta point to be taken here, which is that what we are seeing, that Donald Trump might call someone, we don't know what he intended to do. I think we don't need to give him the benefit of the doubt on this, but that Donald Trump might call a potential witness to try and cajole them into doing a certain thing, which is pretty clear, which would be pretty clear, sort of witness tampering as we understand it, is a function of his having done this stuff for so long and not being held to account. You know, the fact that during the Russia probe, he obstructed the Russia probe, that he withheld information from Robert Mueller, that he withheld information during his first impeachment. And all of those things, he got a pat on the head from, you know, first Bill Barr and then second the Republicans in the Senate. He has paid no price for standing in the way of efforts to hold him to account. And so he continues to try and, you know, apparently stand in the way of efforts to hold him to account. And that, of course, is the entire point of the January 6th committee's work. They want to hold him to account so that he doesn't think he can get away in the future with potentially trying to undermine the results of an election.
Philip Pop, national correspondent for The Washington Post. And in fact, among his several articles on yesterday's hearing is one headlined, Trump has never been held accountable for impeding inquiries. It shows. So we'll see next week what happens this time. Philip, thanks so much for your time today.
Of course.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.